Now about 8 days after these sayings, he took with him Peter and John and James and went up to the mountain to pray. And as he was praying, the appearance of his face was altered. His clothing became dazzling white. And behold, two men were talking with him, Moses and Elijah, who appeared in glory and spoke of his departure, which he was about to accomplish at Jerusalem. Now Peter and those who were with him were heavy with sleep, but when they became fully awake, they saw his glory and the two men who stood with him. And as the men were parting from him, Peter said to Jesus, "Master, it is good that we are here. Let us make three tents, one for you and one for Moses and one for Elijah," not knowing what he said. As he was saying these things, a cloud came and overshadowed them, and they were afraid as they entered the cloud. And a voice came out of the cloud saying, "This is my son, my chosen one. Listen to him." And when the voice had spoken, Jesus was found alone, and they kept silent and told no one in those days anything of what they had seen. You may be seated. Apart from Easter morning itself, the Mount of Transfiguration, it's the pinnacle of the Gospels. Throughout Luke's Gospel, we've seen moments when Jesus' glory breaks through in miracles, in healings. And if those miracles that we've seen are like steam vents coming up through the crust of the earth, well, the Transfiguration is like a volcanic blast. It shakes the earth. And if we will attend to what the Transfiguration teaches us about Jesus Christ, it will reshape our lives and transform us. So what does the transformation teach us about Jesus? Three simple points. The Transfiguration teaches us who he is, what he came to do, and how we can receive it. Who is Jesus? What did he come to do? And how can we receive it? Number one, who is he? Now, more than almost any other miracle, the Transfiguration tells us who Jesus is. And you really see this in three ways in the text. Notice the voice from heaven. You see it in the relationship between Jesus and the two people that are with him, Moses and Elijah. And then you see it in the appearance of Jesus himself. So if you look down at the text at verse 35, a voice came out of the cloud saying, "This is my son." I knew I'd get your attention by doing that. "This is my son, my chosen one, listen to him." Now, that's pretty clear. Voice comes from heaven, identifies Jesus Christ as the Son of God. Okay, we know who he is, but look at the relationship between Jesus and Moses and Elijah. If you know anything about the Hebrew Bible, you know that Moses and Elijah feature prominently. Moses led Israel out of Egypt to the borders of Canaan. He also authored the first five books of the Bible, the Torah, the law. And then in the Hebrew scriptures, immediately following the law, are the prophets. And there were lots of prophets, Isaiah, Amos. But the most famous Old Testament prophet was Elijah. People regarded Elijah as the most effective, the most successful, the most powerful prophet in Israel's history. And so, these two men appear on the Mount as representatives of all God's prior revelation. Think about it. The law and the prophets. That's a shorthand for the Old Testament. In other words, they appear on the Mount of Transfiguration because they both, the law and the prophets, foreshadowed what was coming. So here's Moses, the great lawgiver, and here is Elijah representing the prophets, and here is Jesus, head and shoulders above them both. So what is Luke saying? Here's what he's saying. Jesus is not just another prophet pointing the way to God. He is the Son of God to whom the prophets and the law pointed. He is the one. He has not merely come to continue Moses' ministry or Elijah's ministry. He has come to fulfill everything they wrote, everything they said. So we see, we hear the voice from heaven. We see Jesus in relation to the law and the prophets. But we also see who Jesus is through his own appearance. He goes up to the mountain to pray. A cloud descends. God speaks from heaven, and his face radiates with light. Now, if you're familiar at all with the Old Testament, your mind is going back to Exodus 33 and 34, where Moses goes up a mountain to pray, and a cloud descends, and God speaks from heaven. And Moses says, God, show me your glory. And God says what? I can't show you my glory. If I were to show you my glory, Moses, it would obliterate you. You cannot see my face, for man shall not look at me and live. But, says God, I will hide you in the cleft of the rock, and as my glory passes by, I will shield you, I will put my hand over you, and when I pass by, you'll be able to see my glory from the backside. And what happened? After this happened, Moses came down from the mountain, and his face was radiant with light. You see what's going on? It's the same story, but with one fundamental difference. When Moses went up on the mountain, the light of God shone upon him. But when Jesus is on the mountain, Luke says the light of God shone from within him. To put it another way, Moses reflected the light of God's glory, but Jesus produces and projects the light of his glory. In other words, when God invited Moses to come to the Mount of Transfiguration, he was doing two things. He was showing Moses the rock in which he hid him so that his glory wouldn't destroy him in the face of the sun. And because the Son of God is incarnate, he was finally showing him his face. So if you go out tonight, do this later on. It's a nice bright moon outside right now. If you go out at night and you look up at the moon, you realize that you're not actually seeing moonlight because the moon has no light of its own. What is it? It's sunlight. It's reflected sunlight, and that's Moses, reflected glory. But when, Luke says, when you see the unveiled glory of Jesus, you're staring directly into the noonday sun of God's glory. And here's what this means. Luke is saying this. Jesus Christ embodies the dazzling beauty of the glory of God. You know, you and I try to appear beautiful. And what do? When we want to appear beautiful, what do? We adjust the light. Now, all the ladies in the room know what I'm talking about. Because that's what makeup does, isn't it? What does makeup do? It makes some things lighter and some things darker. It's adjusting the light. If you've ever had to be on video calls for your work and you need to appear like you're not sick, what do? You adjust the light. You need the right light at the right temperature, at the right intensity, shining on you to appear beautiful. But when Jesus reveals his own beauty, it isn't light that shines on Jesus. It's light that streams from him. In other words, Jesus doesn't just appear beautiful. He is the beauty that is beyond all bearing. He is the vision we all need. Why? Because, as Paul says in Colossians 2:9, within him dwells the fullness of deity bodily. Do you want to see God? You will in the face of Christ. That's who he is. But secondly, what did he come to do? What did he come to do? Luke's account of the transfiguration, if you read Matthew, Mark, and Luke, they all record it, but Luke records some details that the other two don't record. So, for instance, while Matthew and Mark both tell us that they went up the mountain, only Luke says they went up the mountain in order to pray. They were going for the purpose of prayer. Luke alone tells us that when the transfiguration took place, the disciples had actually fallen asleep. So it was nighttime. Jesus would pray through the night, and so they were woken up by a blinding light. Both Matthew and Mark record that Moses and Elijah appeared and they talked with Jesus. But listen, only Luke tells us what they talked about. Verse 30. And behold, two men were talking with him, Moses and Elijah, who appeared in glory and spoke of his departure, which was about he was about to accomplish at Jerusalem. Now, you cannot see it in English, but there's a Greek wordplay there. Here's what Luke actually writes. Two men were talking with him, Moses and Elijah, who appeared in glory and spoke to him of his exodus. Now, when the original audience of Luke's gospel read that line, they instantly would have known what Luke was alluding to. The word exodus, Greek word exodus, just means departure. It was a common word. But you know that when Luke uses that word as he's talking with Moses, he's trying to get us to think about something. He's drawing our mind and our memory certain places. So Jesus is explaining his crucifixion, but he's connecting it to the Old Testament story, the paradigmatic story of God's redemption and deliverance. So in the Old Testament, Pharaoh enslaved the children of Israel. He was their master and forced them to do his bidding. And every single day, they had no choice what they wanted to do. They had no way to escape. They had no freedom. Pharaoh owned them, their time, their strength, their lives. And so God sent Moses to deliver them out of their bondage to Pharaoh. So when Moses and Elijah speak with Jesus about his exodus, they are pointing to a greater enslavement and a greater deliverer. You see, you and I were made to serve God. That's why we exist, to know him and to enjoy him and to obey him. But instead of serving the true God, all of us, like Adam, our first father, has said in our hearts, you will not be my master. I'll be my own master. But instead of becoming our own masters, we've actually made ourselves slaves to something else: sin. And here's what I need you to wrestle with. Sin is not just some mistakes that we occasionally make. The Bible teaches that sin is a power that rules over us like a master. Let me prove it to you. In John 8:34, Jesus said, "Everyone who makes the practice of sinning is a slave to sin." Let me tell you how that works in my life and in your life. We all know times when we knew the right thing to do, yet we still chose to get angry and give in to anger, give in to bitterness, give in to hopelessness, give in to anxiety anyway. We all know times when we have said in our hearts, "I will never do this again. I see how awful this is. I see how much destruction it's causing, how much pain it's causing. I will never do this again." Yet the same patterns of bitterness and selfishness and envy continue to draw us back in. If I say from this pulpit, "You're a sinner," you may fight against that label. But deep down, no matter how many resolutions you have made, no matter how much effort you have exerted, you feel the gravity of evil pulling your feet down. We know what that's like. And here's why. It's because sin is a master that owns us until we turn to God. And left to ourselves, the Bible teaches that our slavery to sin ends in death. It ends in separation from God. So here's the message of the Bible, the uncomfortable truth of God's word. When we're born, we are all enslaved to sin. Not to Pharaoh, a much worse master, sin and death. But the good news of the gospel is that because God is merciful, he sent a greater deliverer than Moses, his only son, Jesus Christ. And Jesus Christ, if you will read the gospels, you will learn that he lived as we ought to have lived. He served God fully and perfectly, or to couch it in the terms of the metaphor I have been using the whole time, Jesus Christ in his earthly life made God his master. He lived the life that Adam should have lived, that I should have lived, that you should have lived. He served God fully and completely. He said, not what I will, but what you will, God. And yet, at the cross, Jesus Christ received the ultimate separation from sin that we deserved, death. But here's the thing. When Jesus Christ died, he wasn't dying for his own sins. Whose was he dying for? Ours. Ours. You see, if you think about it for a moment, the Transfiguration and Calvary, two mountains, and they are like the photo negative of one another. On the Mount of Transfiguration, two prophets surround Jesus. At Calvary, two thieves surround Jesus. On the Mount of Transfiguration, Jesus' garments radiate with glory, but on the Mount of Crucifixion, soldiers strip him naked. On the Mount of Transfiguration, light pierces darkness, but at the crucifixion, darkness swallows up the light in divine judgment. And at the Transfiguration, Jesus prays, and the Father answers. But at Calvary, Jesus cries out to God, and heaven is silent. Why would God ignore the prayers of the only righteous man to ever live? It must be so that he can hear the prayers of unrighteous men and women like me and you. Jesus Christ received what we deserve so that we can receive the glory and the beauty of God. God turned his face, as it were, away from the Son so that he could look on us in love and acceptance. That's, friends, that is the core of the gospel message. And God has done that freely because he is full of love. So what does the Transfiguration reveal? What does the cross and Easter accomplish? What did he come to do? He came to die for the sins of his people that he might raise them in everlasting life. So the Transfiguration shows us who he is and what he came to do. Finally, the Transfiguration teaches us how we can receive it. How can you today receive the beauty and the glory in the face of God? Well, one of the reasons that we know that the gospels that we read record accurate history, they're not just fables, is because when you read a story like this, Luke does nothing to try to airbrush the disciples. He doesn't try to paint them in a rosy light. Throughout the gospels, the disciples almost always misunderstand Jesus. They always ask for things they're not supposed to ask for. They often forget to ask for things they're supposed to ask for. They do the things they shouldn't do, and they don't do the things they should do. And frankly, let me just say, if you were one of the disciples writing these stories as fables to try to get people to follow you, you would have never written the Transfiguration like this. Luke portrays the disciples in this passage as weak and clueless. Weak and clueless. Hold on to those two words because they're going to apply to us in a moment. First, they're supposed to be awake. They're supposed to be awake with Jesus to pray. That's why they went up to the mountain. Verse 32, Luke says, Peter and those who were with him were heavy with sleep. as the transfiguration happened. Don't miss this. They got the chance to see the unveiling of the glory of the eternal Son of God, but almost missed it because they were dozy. This is one of the reasons why I never get upset if you fall asleep in this room. I'm serious. I have sat through sermons that have made me tired, and I have closed my eyes and fell asleep. It's okay. I mean it. It's okay. This is a day of rest, by the way. Okay, look. Jesus has to turn on the light of his glory to wake them up. They're weak. They're tired. They're frail. But not only are they weak, as are we, they're also clueless. They don't even understand what they should be doing. They don't even understand that maybe this is not the right time to talk. You know, maybe they should keep their mouths closed for a moment. In verse 33, Peter tries to run the show. Master, it is good that we're here. Let's make three tents, one for you, one for Moses, one for Elijah. And Luke adds this editorial comment, not knowing what he was saying. You can just hear the groan in his writing. If he had emojis, there would have been a facepalm right there. At that moment, a voice from heaven shouts, "This is my son, my chosen one. Listen to him." This is the polite way of translating the Greek that means, "This is my son. Shut up for a minute." Walter Liefeld, in his commentary on this passage, says this. When God speaks from heaven, what is he doing? He's correcting the human tendency to substitute our own opinion for divine revelation. What is Luke saying? He's saying, we're clueless. You and I, you know who we are? We are weak and we are clueless. And so Luke is showing us that the disciples did not earn this moment. They did not understand this moment. They couldn't even stay awake for this moment. Which means this. It means they received the glory of Jesus by grace alone. Unless Jesus wakes them up, they miss the glory. Unless the Father explains what's going on, they misunderstand everything. And so will we. For we are no different than the disciples. We do not receive the glory of Jesus because we're spiritually sharp, morally strong, or wide awake. You need to understand that this morning. Maybe it's your first time at church. Maybe it's your first time in a long time. No one in this room is here today because we're better than anyone else. At the foot of the cross, the ground is level, and we all stand condemned. We're all weak. We're all clueless. We're all miserable. We're all pitiful and puny. We did not receive the good news of Easter because we love God, but because God loves us. Because the deliverance from sin and death and the glory and the beauty of Jesus is ours, not by right, but by grace alone. And so, your place with God, listen, your exodus, the deliverance that you need from sin and death, does not depend on how much you come to church, how well you perform, or how perfect your theology is. It depends on the Son of God, His chosen one, and this Son, Jesus Christ, is offered to you right now, fully and freely, and there are no strings attached. Only believe. In fact, you might say the whole application of this entire sermon is summed up by the words from heaven. This is Jesus, God's Son, the chosen one. Listen to him. Listen to him. That is the call. Trust the one who woke up the disciples. He can wake you too. From spiritual death into spiritual life. Trust the one who walked through death, who rose on the third day, and leads the way into glory. Our God and Father, we